Very good. Oh, lots of questions today. So I have to go through them quickly if there's lots of them. So let's see the first question. Please tell the story of that donkey who fell into the well. Nah. We've got to go through them fast. There's lots of questions. Okay, the donkey who fell into the well. Once upon a time, there was a donkey who was minding its own business, just wandering in the forest, and he fell into a well. He wasn't being mindful, not watching where he was going. Fortunately for the donkey, the well was dry, so the donkey never drowned. But there he was at the bottom of the well. He didn't break any bones, but he was at the bottom of a big hole. And he looked up, and it was a long way to the top, and donkeys can't climb. So what could he do? He stuck down the bottom of a well, not knowing what to do. So, you know, he couldn't call. He couldn't sort of, he didn't have a mobile phone. So all he could do was to shout as loud as he could, trying to get somebody's attention. E-o! 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 And he was as loud as he could. And now 10 minutes went past, 20 minutes went past, half an hour went past, and he was getting, you know, he also got that pony virus, which I had last week. Makes your horse, a little horse. But, but then somebody heard him. And it was this really nasty farmer. And this nasty, bad farmer, he came and saw, wow, a donkey has fallen into the well. And I don't like donkeys. You know, they're stubborn, they smell. They smell, you know. Do you know that? Go smell the back of a donkey. Blew. But anyway, so it smelled, and that was a dangerous hole. So the farmer thought, I always meant to fill up that well. And why not fill the well up with the donkey inside? Very nasty. So he got out a spade and started shoveling dirt into the well. Instead of trying to save the donkey, the farmer was going to bury the donkey alive. And all this dirt was thrown on the donkey, another shovel full of dirt, and the donkey started shouting out louder, E-o! 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 Which was in donkey language, meant, you know, just save me, don't kill me, it's not fair. In donkey language, bad karma, farmer, bad karma. That's what E-o was in donkey language. You don't believe me, do you? I know that many of you were suggesting you wanted to translate some of these stories and videos into Chinese and into Bahasa. So how about translating them into donkey? You know, it's true, actually. Somebody showed me this. They showed me that, you know, my talks, many people, they don't listen to the talks, even though they live close by, because, you know, going there and finding a place in the park, they actually watch it stream live at home, you know, my Friday night talks. And they showed me that every Friday night, even this dog comes in front of the computer and sits there to watch me. So it's amazing. That's true. They can show me a photograph of it. It's amazing how many disciples I've got now. Even dogs. They sit there, watch. And but anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, the donkey in the well. So the donkey thought, this is really cruel person killing me alive like this. And the farmer just was very happy. At last he can get rid of that pesky donkey and fill up the hole. And just shoveling it in. And then suddenly the donkey went quiet. And the farmer thought, he must have already buried the donkey. So he carried on shoveling, but just, you know, taking it easy. But then what happened was what the farmer never saw, was inside the well. The donkey wasn't buried yet, but the donkey developed insight. Not struggling and complaining of how unfair it is to get buried alive instead of being helping him. The donkey decided to get insight and wisdom. The next shovel full of earth over its back, the donkey shrugged it off, stamped it in under his feet, which is why I came close on to the edge here so I could act like a donkey, and stamped it in. I was a centimetre higher. Another shovel full of dirt on the donkey's back, shrugged it off, and stamped it in. And every shovel full of earth, the donkey was getting a little bit higher, a little bit closer to freedom. And another shovel full of earth, shrug it off, and a pair of ears, just the top of ears, appeared above the well. But that farmer was busy just shoveling it. The farmer wasn't mindful or paying attention. Every shovel full of earth, and saw the head appeared above the well, and then half the body appeared above the well, until the donkey was close enough to the top, he jumped up out of the well, and he bit the farmer on the backside, because that was how he'd explained to him to always watch your ass. That's mindfulness. And then ran away. And that is how the donkey escaped. Don't complain. People throw all sorts of rubbish on you. And I remember one of the first times that I went to see, at that time it was a president of Sri Lanka, Rajapaksa. And, you know, being a president, you always have to make some very difficult decisions. And you always get, being a president, always in the newspapers, being criticized for this, told off for that. And, of course, they do make some bad decisions, sometimes some good decisions. It's very hard being a president. But anyway, I told him that. He said, well, you know, you're in the bottom of a well, and somebody, some of the newspapers or the opposition, they throw dirt all over you. What should you do? Shrug it off, stamp it in, and you're a little bit higher to freedom. He thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. So it's teaching Buddhism which actually related to him and his life. The donkey story. So that's the donkey story. There's another similar story. This time it wasn't a donkey falling down a well. It was a person falling down the well. And the reason they fell down the well, actually they jumped into that well, because they were just walking through the forest, and they were spotted by a tiger. You know, the tigers, they were all around Thailand when I was there. And, you know, they would eat monks. They were very dangerous. And so, and I tell people, you know, that one day I came, it's amazing just when you've got really good meditations, yeah, unexpected things, even you know, sometimes you don't know what's going to happen when you get face to face with a tiger. Because I was face to face with a tiger once. Huge tiger. It was only maybe about half the distance between you and me. That was the tiger. And you know what? The amazing thing was, I wasn't scared. I was just really peaceful. It's amazing. Not scared at all. Can you believe that? It was in a zoo. Big But anyway, this was a real tiger in the jungle chasing this guy. And the guy was running for his life. And he knew tigers can run much faster than you can. And number two, once a tiger spots you, that's lunch or dinner. So anyway, he knew he was in big trouble. And so he saw a hole in the ground there, and it was one of these wells, but you know, the donkey had gone out a long time ago, so it was an open well. And so he had no choice. He committed to jump. And once he committed to jump into the well, because the tiger was on his tail, as soon as he committed to jump, he saw in that well, it was another of these dry wells, but it didn't have a donkey in the bottom. It had a big black snake coiled up in the bottom. And so, you know, intuitively, just reflex, he reached the side of the well and he caught hold of a root which was poking through the side of the well to hold on to it to stop his fall. And it stopped his fall. But all the commotion and a bit of loose earth falling to the bottom onto that snake's head woke him up. Now, you know, most people, if you woke up in the middle of your nap or sleep, especially dirt on top of your head, you're not in a good mood. And that snake was in a really bad mood. Who is disturbing my beauty sleep like this? And he saw this guy now hanging on a root of a tree. So the snake uncoiled itself, lifted up its head, opened its hood and aiming for the man's feet. But his feet were just slightly too high. You know, not that much too high. And so the snake was trying to stretch to try and catch this guy on the feet to teach him a lesson. But the snake just couldn't reach. It's just a little bit too far away. So the man was safe for a little while. But then he looked up. The tiger hadn't given up either. The tiger was leaning into the well with his paws trying to paw him. And his hand holding the root was just a little bit, you know, just too low. So the tiger couldn't reach it. But it was close enough. It kept on leaning over to try and reach it. And then he noticed, the man, that there's a hole next to the, only a tiny hole, next to the root. And two mice came out, a black mouse and a white mouse. And they started to chew at the root, making it thinner and thinner. And if that wasn't bad enough, the tiger, leaning over, not really noticing what he was doing with his backside, the backside was rubbing against the tree, making it shake. And that tree had a branch overhanging the well with a big bee's nest on that tree. And as it was shaking the beehive, honey started to drip down the well. And he didn't need to stretch, he just put out his tongue to taste the delicious honey, like wild honey. And it was so sweet and delicious. And that's the end of the story. Because that's what life is like. We always need endings, the end of a retreat. This is not the end of the retreat tomorrow or the next. There's always another retreat going on afterwards. Things don't end. And that's like life. Sometimes we're caught between a tiger at the top and a snake underneath us, and the black mouse and the white mouse stand for night and day, eating at our precarious hold on safety. You've got so much to worry about, but it doesn't matter. Between a snake, a deadly snake, and a tiger, and your hold on safety is being chewed thinner and thinner, there's always some honey dripping down from the well. So never forget, you've got cancer, you're dying, your financial ruin, everything is going wrong in your life, but remember the honey. Delicious. And it's the end of the story, because that's what life is like. It never has neat endings. Even when you die, you get reborn again, here we go again. So, but, of course, Ajahn Brahm has his ending to the story. Always keep a positive mind, and it could happen. Because what I in my story, end of the story, the tiger, he started all of this. It was because of the tiger the snake woke up, and he had to jump in the well, and the mice came out, and the bees, and they were mad. But what happened? The tiger, leaning over, you know we do these things, leaned over a little bit too far, lost its balance, fell into the well. just missed the guy, only by just, and went straight on top of the snake, crushed the snake to death, and broke its own neck. So that with the two problems solved, the tiger dead and the snake crushed, he could just take his time and gently climb out of the well and carry on with his walk. That could happen. Maybe in life the unexpected things happen and we are safe. So that is another well story. The third well story. This is one of Ajahn Chah's, very rarely I say, it's a short one, that a man was walking through the forest and he saw a well. And at the bottom of the well, there was a lot of ancient gold coins worth a fortune. You know, in a sort of a little bucket or something. Don't know why people had buried it there. And he leant in to try and pick up the gold. But the little basket was a little bit too low. And he stretched and stretched and stretched. And no matter how much he stretched, he just couldn't reach the gold. So he walked away. And this other guy passed him and said, I heard there's a treasure in there. He said, yeah, I know, but the hole's too deep. And this fellow said, you're looking at the wrong way. It's not the hole's too deep. Your arm is too short. So he lengthened his arm by grabbing hold of a stick and pulled the gold out. So in life, you always think, oh, it's too difficult. Oh, the hole is too deep. The hole is never too deep. It's your arm is too short. So lengthen your arm and you can get the gold. That's Ajahn Chah's story, because we all like, you know, talking about sort of wells and holes, because this is the holy life, after all. Okay, here we go. That's like, you know, the last executive retreat. We held that in Bangkok, just next to Suvarnabhumi, right close to the airport. And it was called Suvarnabhumi Golf Club and Resort. He said, what's a monk doing in a golf course? He said, it's obvious. Haven't you ever heard of Hole in One? Holy One. Let's go to Holy One. It's called me. Many people know about good and bad and also understand karma. But why still we can do bad things or bad karma again? What we can do if the negative thinking, bad feeling come to us. Sometimes let it go is easy to say but difficult to do. Now that somebody put in a very beautiful way, you know, the troubles of life is that it's good people in bad systems. In other words, that, you know, they're not encouraged or allowed to do the right thing. You know, to be kind, sometimes you get the sack. You know, to sort of see, notice a wonderful thing, a wonderful solution, and then you lose your job. So that's why the Ajahn Sujata told me this, that when a council officer came to see him years ago in Santi Monastery over in Sydney, it's the council officer said their motto in that part of the world was care. All the officers in the HR department were taught to care. What did care mean? Cover, arse, retain employment. In other words, they're just looking after, it's not care. But sometimes the system doesn't reward kindness and goodness. You know, even when I was at school studying, now one of the things I hated about studying is exams where I had to compete against my best friend. And you know, all your friends, when it came to exam time, we weren't allowed to help each other. And I wanted to help, cooperate. And the teacher said, no, that's cheating. It's not cheating, it's compassion, it's kindness, helping one another. You know, you don't understand what life is all about, teacher. So it's true, isn't it, that in real life we have to help one another and look after one another and work together. But sometimes because we learn competition, you know, we can't help. That's called cheating. And that you can see that it's a system sometimes causes the problems. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, just in education, you always, you know, try new ways of looking at things. And my suggestion, you know, was that we have, at the end of the year, 70% of your final score will be what you got yourself in the exam. And the other 30% will be averaged over the class in which you belong. So in other words, they get, you know, 30 kids in the class, they get their exam results, and then they add them all together, divide them by the 30, and that's part of your score. And the other 70%, say, is your own personal score. So you actually get rewarded for cooperation, for helping one another. So the bright kid has to help the less able kid, so that, because if the bright kid, the geniuses, don't help the other ones, everyone does bad. Just like life. So that's one of the reasons why the cooperation, you know, leads to, you know, to not doing so much bad karma. It's all about me, what I want. And just like the story in a family, five fingers in the hand. If one of my fingers gets sick and gets injured, you can't use any of the fingers. And I say that in Indonesia, you know, the Pancasila, the five religions. And I say that in public. Five religions, you know, in Indonesia. And if one of those religions suffers, it's like fingers in the hand. It doesn't matter if the fat one, the tall one, the small one. If one of those fingers gets injured, the whole gets injured. And you can't use the whole hand. It's a nice little simile of how we have to cooperate. We have to work together. So too much competition is one of the reasons why that we do bad karma. Devajan Brahm, how to apply be slow to meet people's demand in the multitasking, fast decision-making world. How to react to people when they criticize slow as a demerit. Sometimes, have you ever seen a doctor doing an operation? And you say, come on, fast, fast. Is slow always bad? There are many times, like a doctor doing an operation. What's another example of when slow is really... Because slow is sometimes more careful. So slow, enjoy the moment. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could teach clocks to go slow? So everything's just so that you enjoy it. So what else can go? You want to sort of criticize slow. Oh, what about driving cars? Why do they have to be so fast? Because they get dangerous when they go fast. There was this gentleman. He lived out in a nice, peaceful part of the world, in the countryside. And, you know, that for some reason that people would take a shortcut around these country roads to save time, and they would speed. And the speeding, it wasn't so much dangerous, but it was just causing a lot of noise, and his cows and his sheep were just getting scared all the time. So he asked the local council, can he put up a speed limit? You know, maybe like 40 kilometers an hour, you know, past his farm. What did the local council, local government say? No, we can't do that. Everyone will ask for it. So he thought, I'll put my own speed limit up. So he, you know, had a little shop and did a nice little sign, a nice little 40 kilometers an hour and a real red around it. And then the police came and said, you can't make your own police signs. You take it down now. And so he tried his counsel, he tried to do it himself, and then he found a solution. To slow the cars down, past his farm. He put a big sign up on the side of the road, so mostly male drivers, and the sign said, "Nudist Colony." And all the cars slowed down. That's an old joke. You know, because guys, men, you know, just knew this guy. Oh, let's go down, have a look at this. Anyway. So slow is a demerit. No, sometimes slow is beautiful. And the other time to do slow, have you ever been in an argument with a person? And it gets really hot and angry. When you're in an argument, you always start to speak high pitch and very fast. And you speak like this and it's very exciting and you get very upset. You don't know what you're saying and the blood pressure goes up and the heart starts to beat. Remember? If you learn how to be slow, someone's arguing with you. And then you start to slow down your speech. And as you are speaking slowly, the other person's anger goes down as well. Yeah, try it. How you can actually control other people. You know, it takes a lot of mindfulness and a little bit of restraint, a bit of training. But if somebody's really arguing and they're really in front of you, their eyes are bulging and 2 meters from your nose, you just start, but also with a low tone, not a high pitch, because that excites people, but very low and calm. And then your blood pressure goes down when I am talking like this. And many of you will start to fall asleep. The tone and the pace of speech can do a lot to control another person's emotions. So slow is also wonderful. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in your book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, you said part of your job is listening to people's problems and receive all the rubbish. You're like a dustbin with a hole in the bottom. My question, how does the hole work? What if there's a blockage? You can go to just the toilet cubicles. You've got the toilet brush. You just unblock it. And it only blocks because you let it sit there for too long. If immediately it goes right out, you don't sit there at all, in other words, it goes right the way through, then you're always open for the next person to dump their rubbish in. That's a wonderful thing. So you don't keep it and just take it away with you. There's many people with counselors, carers, doctors who have that problem. You know that you're there helping, looking after somebody, and then something goes wrong, or it's just such a difficult problem. And then afterwards you take it home with you. And you know, you should never do that. Just where it comes, there, you leave it, allow it to go through. That's out of kindness and compassion for others as well. People you live with, you need a break, you need a rest. So please, you know, whatever you're doing in any counseling, caring, whatever, you just allow it to go straight through. Otherwise, the problems in life are just too heavy. And because they're heavy, you get worn out. So this is Ajahn Chah's simile. And he did this, and I saw, I remember the place he did this for me. Coming back on arms round, and he stopped by the side of the path. He picked up a stick. He said, "Brahma Wangsa, how heavy is the stick?" Before I could answer, he said, "It's only heavy when you keep holding it." And it's simple. Simple teachings like that. The stick is only heavy when you hold it. A problem is only burdensome when you keep carrying it around. What did you do that for? Soon we learn how to hold the stick for a little while, learn, and then we let it go. But I don't know why I listen to people's problems. Could people ask me about marriage? I've never been married. Raising kids, haven't done that. You know, but I always say something. But no one of the weirdest times was as one of the friends, he used to, you know, he was a disciple, come through the talks, and especially the little talks we had in Armadale group, and he let on that he was a radio producer. And he said, you know, that you get all these JoJos come on these late night shows and give advice to people. And he said, you know, you're much better than these people, so why don't you come on my show? So, yeah, okay, I don't mind. So, but when is it? He said, well, it's just about 10 o'clock, 10 till midnight. I said, that's a bit late, but it was a Friday night, and what I could do the Friday night talk at Nolamara and then immediately get in the car and just go to the radio studios. So I said, yeah, I'm up for anything, something new, interesting. Because when you've been a monk for 44 years, you get a bit bored and there's all of something different. Same old, same old. This is interesting. So off I went. And then when I was there, I only managed to get into the studio, you know, just the last moment, because I was a bit late. So I rushed into the studio, never really had a chance for any introductions, just put the mic, you know, because the red light goes on, put the headphones on, the microphone, get it all set up, and we had to start straight away. And the compere, or whatever it was, the fellow who was running the show, my friend was in the back, you know, producing it. And he said, welcome to this evening's show. And we are very fortunate today to have two special guests. And the first guest who's often been on this show is Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, the Australian expert on adult matters, who wrote many, many books about sex. And that's when I got worried. What show am I on? And I did do my research. I did ask what show it was. I should have known late night, 10 p.m. to 12 p.m., and it wouldn't be on about sort of, you know, play school or anything. This was just adult stuff. So anyway, and they said, you know, and they tried, but they just could not pronounce my name, so it became Mr. Monk, the professor of Mr. Monk, and invited questions from the audience live, and they said, you can actually ask which one you want to ask your question, you know, on intimate matters. It was too late to run out. So, okay, give everything a go. And so there I was for 2 hours answering intimate questions from the audience and from people who phoned in about their love life and all sorts of other stuff. And one of the ones which I got, I would always remember this one because, you know, that sometimes as a monk, you know, you're not too involved, so you can actually stand back, you can get an understanding. And I answered this question perfectly because it was a taxi driver, you know, waiting for a fare late at night on the radio on. He said, I want to ask Mr. Monk. He said, I'm married with kids. I'm having an affair with a wife, with a beautiful woman. My wife doesn't know. Is that okay? That's what he asked. And I shot back straight away, sir, if it was okay, you would not be ringing me up to ask. And he hung up the phone. I nailed him straight away. Because if he was okay, then, you know, he'd feel good about it, and so there wouldn't be any problem. He was ringing it up because he felt guilty. He wanted some expert to say, well, it's okay. So anyway, I had lots of fun like that. But it was the case that it was just, you can not make it up as you go along, that if you have a bit of kindness and wisdom, stand back, it's amazing. Well, not even a monk, you know, can understand a lot about life. What was it in Hong Kong U, that time that I gave a talk, and I think it was one of the most well-attended talks on, was it sex, money and marriage or family or something? You remember that one? Yeah. And so, if, you know, I said, well, you know, I don't know really what I'm talking about, but, but you know, you got to the point because you can understand just how that relates to so many other things in life. Anyway, can you tell me once more that it is okay to meditate in short sections? It is okay to meditate in short sections. Of course it is. Ajahn Chah used to say that, how long you should meditate for? He said, well, an hour is good. If you can't do an hour, half an hour is better than nothing. And if you can't do half an hour, no, 15 minutes. That's better than nothing at all. If you can't do 15 minutes, no, do 10 minutes. And you haven't got 10 minutes, 5 minutes. You haven't got 5 minutes, 1 minute. Not 1 minute, 30 seconds. Better than nothing at all. So keep it natural, keep it easy, and don't force yourself. Another question of urgency born of selfishness. This morning you said there is the law of karma. What you ask another to do today, you'll be asked to do tomorrow. Well, that's just generally speaking, but not always the case. But it's always just be careful, you know, what you tell somebody else to do. Because if it's something which is very, very hard, you should have done it yourself, sometimes it does come back to you. There are very few things that cannot be done better the second time around. And I have asked, inflicted on others things inconsiderate, ill-conceived, bad, out of ill will. There may be mitigation of use, circumstances, stupidity, etc. I've done terrible things as well. You know, one of those terrible things which I did to my mother? Poor old mum. I was really, you know, sometimes people, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you must have been born sort of with a bald head. Coming out of your mother's womb, sitting cross-legged, being holy. That's not the case. One of the things which I did for my poor old mum. I must have been about 6 or 7 years of age. Can't remember for sure, but no, not 8 was a little bit old. So it was my mother's birthday, November the 6th. My mum's birthday. And I was only about 7 or 8 years of age. I saved up some pocket money to get her a present, a special present. She knew nothing about this. I kept it a secret. I already had a little shoebox and some wrapping paper, you know, really nice wrapping paper, and a little card with some ribbon. Then I went to get the ingredients of the little box. Because at that time in London, they had it was like a food fad, you know, and it was mashed potato and jellied eels. The long fist, eels. And so just round the corner from where we lived, there was a shop that they specialised in mashed potato and jellied eels. So I went there in the morning and I asked for, not a jellied eel, for a live one. Because you can take them and cook it yourself later on, make it fresh. So I asked for a live eel, you know, about this long. And I put it in a box. And I wrapped it up really carefully, you know, in a nice little ribbon and a bow and a little card to Mummy. Happy birthday, love your son, XXX. And the amazing thing was I could keep the straight face. I never let on and what was inside. And I said, Mummy, happy birthday. Mummy, oh, sweet. You did it all by yourself. I wonder what's inside. Surprise, I've opened it, open it. And she opened it up really slowly. And she unpacked the wrapping paper. And she opened it up. And the eel, I couldn't have trained it to do better. Because as soon as she opened up, the eel raises. My mother screamed so loud. But, you know, I was wise enough even then to have my, they call it exit strategy. I knew exactly where to run and hide for a couple of hours until my mum cooled down. So I was a very loving kid. I did that. Oh, bad Peter, bad Ajahn Brahm. So he did some stupid wrong things. But this is, you know, you learn from these things and you know, you You know, my mother never punished me for that. She said, I was just kids being kids, and they're just having a bit of fun. A wonderful attitude towards that. You know, it was but don't do it next time, she said. Is there some way, some technology to stop bad karma brought on by myself from arising and bearing fruit? The best way is to let it go. Stop focusing on it. And I look back upon that, and I look back with laughter, and I share it with other people. I'm not embarrassed, I'm just a 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kid just messing around. So how many of you have been messing around and do stupid things? And but, you know, that's how we learn. And so to stop bad karma, if you've got a negative mind, you bring up bad karma. If you've got a positive mind, the bad karma tends to disappear. I understand, rightly or wrongly, in the Buddhist Tibetan tradition, ritual, some deity for this purpose, is that for real? Any other comments on the above? The best one is to understand and learn from mistakes. And number two, the other way, which is straight from the Buddha's teachings, that if you have done something bad and you feel really bad about it, they say, don't just feel bad about it, do something. And they always say that it's like adding a spoon of salt into, say, a big tablespoon of salt into this cup and stirring it up. I can't drink it, it's too salty. But if I take the same amount of salt and put it in one of those big water tanks on top of the hill, which feed us with our water supply, and stir it all up, you won't even taste it. It's so much clean water, pure water, and the same amount of salty water, you won't know it's there. And that's what the Buddha said about you dilute your bad karma. And you can dilute the bad karma, give donations to temples or jhana grove or whatever. But sometimes there was this girl and she was working up in the north of Western Australia, up in the mines. And as she was working up there, nothing much to do up there. So she asked her best friend and her best friend's partner, let's just go in the car and just go in the desert, just drive around, see if we can find something interesting. And so when her best friend and her best friend's, I think, a fiancé at the time, that they didn't want to go. They just wanted to relax, maybe watch a movie on the video. They said, no, let's get out. So she talked them into going out. And when they were going out in the bush, the not very good roads, they lost control of the car. And the car crashed, turned over, and her best friend died. The best friend's fiance, paraplegic, she was fine. No injuries. And she came, I remember seeing me, she said, if I hadn't argued and encouraged my friend and her fiance to come with me, they'd still be alive today. I feel so bad. And even that wasn't the reason why they went out for a drive. It was an accident. These things happen. But she felt so guilty. So saying, oh, just let it go, obviously it doesn't work. Say, well, yeah, I know. You shouldn't really blame yourself, but I want you to start doing some donations. But not of money. Of your time. Go and volunteer in the rehab departments of in Shenton Park here in Perth for people who have accidents or had injuries. Go and help there. Volunteer. Because when you help others in that certain area, you're actually doing something. Doing something which you feel you need to do to pay off your debt. It's no real debt at all, but it's a good thing to do anyway. So that's what she did. She did volunteer work for a long time. So that's how we can do things. And if you feel it's not your fault, but sometimes these things happen, we think we need to do something. So that's a wonderful direct way of helping. In the Metta Sutta, there is peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. What does skillful mean here? It means that you do things which are appropriate. A skillful thing to do is when Ajahn Brahm tells a joke, it is skillful to laugh. Especially if you're a couple of novices sitting in the back and want to get ordained later on. That's skillful. It's appropriate to the purpose. So, in other words, is it skillful to run? If you're late for an aircraft, and when run? Or if there's a fire, then run. But, you know, for most time, it's not a good idea to run. So, skillful is appropriate actions and speech, you know, to the purpose. By not holding to false views. What are these false views? They are views which create more problems in the Jhana Grove and in other places. False views such as, you'll never be able to take any money with you when you die, except the story of... I'll stop singing. There's a lawyer, really wealthy lawyer, and got cancer. Nothing could to help him, so he's about to die. So he thought in his bed, all this story of you can't take it with you. There must be a loophole somewhere. Because that's what lawyers are great at, doing loopholes. And he thought on his, you know, the last few days how he could do this, and he got this brainwave, you know, the eureka moment, the light bulb. I can find a way to take it with me. So he told his wife, go to the bank, got two suitcases, you know, he signed all the checks and orders and stuff. Go to the bank and fill these two suitcases with banknotes. What's the biggest donation? It's euros, isn't it? That's the biggest donation, biggest currency. Pounds. Okay, pounds. £100 notes. Nothing less. So I want as many as you can. Fit them into those two suitcases. And then I want you to, about when this is my deathbed in my room, this is where I'm going to die, I know, in only a couple of days. Right above this room is the attic. And I want you to put those two suitcases, position them carefully, either side of my bed. So, when I die, I can grab them as I go up. That's my plan. Do it. So, you know, the wife had no choice in those last will and testament. So I went to the bank and filled these, you know, a couple of million in each suitcase. And position him carefully just above his bed. And then that night he died. And of course they were busy just, you know, getting the body and certifying he was dead. And then when it was an appropriate moment, she went up into the attic. And those two suitcases were still there. And she talked to herself and said, stupid man, he should have put those suitcases in the room below the bed. That's the way he's going to go. It's only a joke. Would meditation make people go to the subconscious and confuse people of what is real? No, because meditation makes life more real. The subconscious becomes conscious. The hindrances which bend perception become give you clarity. The simile is, I'm better going quick because there's lots of questions here. The simile is, if there's a lake and there's a wind blowing, that lake has ripples on the surface or waves on the surface. Whenever the lake is disturbed with ripples or waves caused by the wind, you cannot get an accurate reflection of the moon and the stars in the heavens above. But you know, sometimes if you go into the mountains and it's a very still, windless night, that lake is like a mirror. And you have a perfect reflection, especially of the full moon. I think it was in Japanese art, they always say the best way to view, even paint or photograph a full moon, is when it's reflected in a still forest lake. Dear Ajahn, did you ever have doubts on this path? What convinced you the Buddha's teachings is the right and only way to end rebirth? Thank you. I was an odd monk because I never did have doubts about, especially being a monk. And I've mentioned that to someone, I think interviews or somewhere, that when I was first ordained in Bangkok as a novice, you do the novice thing first of all, just to see if you can, you fit in. And I would wake up in the middle of the night for the first 4 or 5 nights in a sweat with a nightmare. I had nightmares. In Bangkok, long way from home, now a monk, now in brown robes anyway, I wake up with this nightmare. But my nightmare was, this is no exaggeration, my nightmare was that I was a layperson. I just opened my eyes to see my robes, folded neatly next to my, on the floor, on the little mattress I was sleeping on. I'm a monk. I made it. And I close my eyes and go into this peaceful sleep. And there was something in the subconscious there, just how much I wanted to be a monk. It was something so deep inside of me, so for me, no doubt. And I got well known, the other monks in Thailand, they said if anyone wanted to leave monkhood or wanted to disrobe, don't go and talk to me. Because I love being a monk, it's a wonderful lifestyle. Every now and then you say you don't need to change. Well, I don't really mean that. Please change your clothes, change your pants, change your underwear. Yeah. For obvious reasons. What if that person's a serial killer, killing for pleasure? Serial killers don't kill for pleasure. Sometimes they're a bit crazy. That's why they do these things. And they don't need to change. A lot of times they're just running away from something, addictions or whatever. What if that person's a drug addict? And what if a person's got alcohol addiction? If they try to change, a lot of times the reason why they have those addictions, the old lack of self-esteem, but, big, exaggerated, I'm not worthy enough, to get better. I don't deserve, to have a happy life. But then when they love themselves, accept themselves, they find what's really inside of them is something very beautiful, like the simile of the lotus. The outside may look really weird and cause them to do some really self-destructive behavior. But when you don't change, but you go inside, you see what's really inside of you. So they shouldn't need change now. So it's not changing and demeaning yourself, trying to get rid of yourself. It's going inside and see something more, which is already inside of you. You don't need to get it or change it. You just actually see what's really there. The old two bad bricks in the wall. Do you need to change that wall? No, you actually see just what else is in the wall. And as I mentioned, that story, the two bad bricks in the wall, which you should all know by now, over in Carnot Prison Farm, this last year, because the monks go and visit there, there was one person, a murderer, and he was going around saying, it was only two murders, only two bad bricks, only murdered two people. He's saying that, okay, fair enough. You shouldn't have done that, but at least you've got some perspective, and maybe you can actually get a life afterwards and let it go. What should we say to a dying person in a palliative ward so as to make him or her feel less miserable, angry, and to develop some peace of mind before she expires? I was telling this story about good old Ted, a Yorkshire man, and he, he was a smoker, because old at that time, people didn't realize that smoking was bad for your health. So eventually he got lung cancer, and he was put in the hospice at Murdoch, St. John of God. And I went to visit him, And actually, the first day was just to settle him in. And what happened was that evening, the nurse came up to him and said, "What do you want for dinner this evening, Ted?" And that's when Ted said, "I cannot have anything oily or greasy or because I've got cholesterol, high cholesterol. And I can't have anything sweet or syrupy because I've got diabetes. And I can't have anything salty because I've got hardened arteries." And apparently the nurse looked at Ted and said, "Ted, what on earth are you talking about? You're not going to, cholesterol's not going to get you. Not diabetes or hardened arteries. You know, you've only got a few days left. The cancer's going to kill you. You can eat whatever you want, Ted. What do you want to eat? As oily, salty, syrupy and sugary as you want." And Ted's eyes went wide. And he ordered all this food, which his doctor and his wife would not let him get near, even smell, let alone eat. All his favourite dishes, which were bad for your health, but really delicious. And he had them all. And 7 days later, he walked out of that hospital in remission. And it's a true story. 6 months later, his cancer came back, and he went back to die properly. But he had an extra 6 months, simply because he was enjoying himself. Never forget the importance of joy and happiness. So that's one of the things I would do. If you're, if someone's in hospital feeling really, well, at least eat, what do you like to eat? You like chocolate chip ice cream with syrup on it. Double strength. Something really oily and greasy. What would you like? Because it's not gonna hurt you. And because you're enjoying stuff, it actually gets better. Oh, okay. That's very kind of you. I will take that one. Thank you. Okay. Very good. So anyway, they're going to go soon anyway, so go with a nice, happy smile and a nice, happy tummy. Can you do that? Depends what they've got, but anyway. Do you read the Mahayana Sutras, such as the Diamond Sutra, the Pure Land Sutra, the Sutra for the Bodhisattvas looking after beings in the hell world? As a Buddhist in Hong Kong, we are told to recite these sutras for our own benefits and others. Who tells you? Is it the people in the hell realms tell you? Because I go to Hong Kong and I don't chant no sutras. And I'm okay. Is this wanting, craving? What do you think of these Mahayana sutras, real teaching from the Buddha? Actually, a lot of them aren't, but it doesn't matter. The core teachings of kindness, but don't act out of fear when they say, you have to do this, or bad spirits will come to you. You'd better chant these, or you'll go to hell. So sometimes acting out of fear, act out of wisdom and compassion. And, you know, sometimes that if you want to, that's fine, but you don't have to. There's many ways of helping beings. Dear Ajahn, if you think you can't see, feeling, thinking, difference, can you explain these, please? If you think you can't see, feeling, thinking, difference, I'll think about it. Does Buddhism believe in astrology? I already mentioned astrology when my horoscope was read. Didn't work. What about thinking about people believing in planetary influences on people? Are they loonies? Full moon does influence on people. True or myth? For the full moon, it's nothing which is like rays or something supernatural. It's just the fact that on a full moon night, it's a very beautiful light. It's restrained. It's not exciting. You have the full sunlight, that, and it's warm and it's sensuous. But the full moon is like subdued, which is one of the reasons why it's a great time to meditate. But it's nothing so supernatural, it's just something else. If someone have hate feeling with me, what should I be doing? I know I should do metta meditation. If someone hates you, that's, well, their bad luck. So, in other words, you have a choice. You don't have to hate them back. And you don't even need to do anything. The story was, if someone gives you a gift, you don't accept it, who does the gift belong to? It goes back to the original owner. So someone hates you, and you don't accept that, you just go along with your life. Then, of course, you know, the hate stays with them until they realize how much it burns and they don't have to hate. After we get back to our work, how do we apply the motto, relax to the max, appropriately, since work is work? But if you work in a spa, you're a massage worker, of course. Or if you work as a concierge or one of those flight attendants, you know, wonderful. If you're a flight attendant or one of the captains on the aircraft, you get on the PA and said, hello, this is Captain Ajahn Brahm here. On behalf of Cathay Pacific, we invite you to relax to the max and enjoy the wonderful in-flight service. In-flight, in-flight service. There's a lot of time you can relax to the max and it works. Now, you're a coach of a soccer team. It's half time, come and relax to the max. You know, you're a teacher and the kids are about to actually go into the exams. Relax to the max, kids. And then when you get inside, then you do well. There's lots of places where relax to the max. You're a doctor doing the pre-operation stuff. And you tell the patient, come on, relax to the max. So you're not worried. So the anesthetic takes him very, very, very quickly. Or you're visiting your grandma and she's on the deathbed. Come on, grandma, relax to the max. And off she goes, she's dead. There's many places where relax to the max actually works. So try that. Tell your boss. When he comes, you've been away too long, so much to do. Boss, relax to the max. Or you want to go to sleep at night. Sleep at night. How many people can't sleep properly at night? So you lay in bed, relax. When we get back to Hong Kong and Indonesia, if we want to review study, go through the word of the Buddha we have on Sutacast, how can we consult with you? Thank you, Ajahn. It's a word of the Buddha, not Ajahn Brahm. So consult with the Buddha. What is animitta samadhi? How to practice it? Oh, then that's just animitta. That's really just very, very deep stuff. Just practice mindfulness of the breath, first of all. You get mindfulness of the breath and just sit still without going to sleep. And then maybe animitta samadhi. That's really just way, way, way down the line. And that is where it's without giving things a sign. Now, is that one? I think that is aparihita, is dukkha. I think it's by practicing just, you know, nothing's reliable. Nothing you can get a really hold on. But I mean, that's really PhD stuff. When you mentioned about monks asking for monies and with their bowls, and that we shouldn't give them money, is that all we could do as a Buddhist, let karma do its work for these fake monks? They cause so much misunderstanding to others who don't know about Buddhism. It is true, because sometimes they say, well, if you don't give a donation, a bad luck is going to come. So sometimes, you know, have some wisdom. Good monks don't accept money. And, there was a professor over for Hong Kong. It was one of Gerald's friends. Gerald went to, was at law school with this girl. And she was exposing fake monks. And she found one over in London. And I don't know if you've seen the video of it. She saw this monk in London, and he was asking for stuff. And so she went up to him, you know, in sort of Cantonese. Where are you from? Oh, I'm a Buddhist monk from China. What part of China? You know, what monastery? How long have you been ordained? Do some chanting, some Buddhist chanting. Chant the Great Metta Sutra or something. He couldn't do it. It was a fake. And so, you know, she knew what she was talking about. And so she exposed, and on camera, he said, take off your robes now, or I'll call the police. And, you know, he did take, he had lay clothes on underneath. It wasn't like he was exposing himself. You know, she knew it was fake. He had lay clothes underneath. Don't ever do that again. And she put it online, you know, to actually embarrass, you know, fake monks. Because they do give good monks a bad name. And good nuns as well. So you don't need, you know, to be too reticent or shy. Just say, this is not what a good monk should do. Now, I'm going to show you a monk certificate. So something to prove you're a monk. And they're not. So they grew up. Dear Ajahn, Arahat has supernatural power. Can you be spared from painful illness? It's, you still have painful illness, but, you know, the two parts of pain, the two parts of suffering, the mental part and the physical part. Still got the physical part, but it's not, oh, I don't want this, why me, how long is this going to last? You have pain, but sometimes it doesn't show. If I strive for the different stages of enlightenment, is it a kind of desire? Would that bring the suffering at the same time? Yeah, it sure will, and you won't get anywhere if you struggle and strive for the different stages of enlightenment. That's aiming for something out there. Let go of the arrow of wanting. It falls right where you are, and that's where enlightenment happens. Oh, God, I'm going well for time. In a few moments, we'll finish off and you'll go back to your rooms to take a rest. And there's another type of meditation which I'm going to prepare you for when you go to bed. It's called the Ananda Method of Enlightenment. Because Ananda was the Buddha's attendant for 25 years, and when I listened to all these amazing teachings of the best teacher, the Buddha himself, be sitting right next to him. Now, you want a glass of water, do you want something? And then Ananda was listening to all these incredible teachings. And these people were coming up to him in like interviews and saying, oh, he's just got this amazing state of mind, the jhanas, and these enlightenment, and these stages of insight and psychic powers, and all these attainments of enlightenment. And he was, you know, just giving a Buddha a glass of water or fanning him if it was too hot, and learning all these other people getting enlightened, but not him. Well, what they used to say, always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Going to all your friends getting married, all of your best friends doing well in life, but you're just still there serving and looking after others. And that was Ananda. So when the Buddha announced he was about to pass away and die, I've blown it. All those years, and I'm not enlightened myself. And if I wasn't enlightened when the Buddha was alive, there's no hope for me. But the Buddha said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, you'll get enlightened. Just like I said, don't worry about the jhanas and stuff. They'll come in good time. Don't worry about it. Just let go. Relax to the max, Ananda. But that didn't really help. So when the Buddha passed away, Ananda thought he was had it, no good. But what happened later on, as many of you know, the senior monks said, well, you know, there's so many different ideas of what the Buddha taught. Why don't we all meet together, all the senior arahats, enlightened ones, and come together so we can collect everything we ever heard about what the Buddha taught, so we can find out, what was real Buddha's teachings, so fake ones can't come in. So they decided to have a conference. It was outside of Rajagaha in the Satapani cave. And they decided to have 500 arahats. But they said, what about Ananda? He was with the Buddha. He got such a great memory, a perfect memory. So they made an exception. 499 perfectly enlightened ones, and the odd one out, Ananda. And he had to go to the meeting the following day. Now imagine how embarrassing that must be. Imagine to understand what it would feel like when I say, imagine that I made the announcement at the end of this retreat that every one of you was fully enlightened with psychic powers except for you. That would be so hard. Well, what did I do wrong? Why me? Everyone else enlightened and I'm not. So that was Ananda, how he felt. So he decided he'd be ashamed to turn up at that meeting the following day, not being enlightened. So he meditated all night. He really went for it. Meditating every trick he knew, he heard from the Buddha, he tried. And when the sun rose, nothing had happened. He was still the same old Ananda, unenlightened as he was the night before. Disappointed, frustrated, he realized there was still another couple of hours before the meeting. So he went to his room to take a nap. And as his head was about to hit the pillow, they always say, before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th arahat. He let go. He stopped struggling. He stopped chasing the carrot. And then the carrot came straight towards him, and he swallowed it. Another enlightened being. And it was, how can I show my friends, prove that I'm enlightened? So he deliberately turned up late. They blocked the doors. And so Ananda, after they locked the doors, he came through the keyhole. Psychic power. It's called making an entrance. And they correct, well done. You've done it. 500th arahat, well done. And that's his method of enlightenment. So, you've still got a chance tonight. And tomorrow, the more times you take a nap, you increase the probabilities, like the chances. Take a nap, that didn't work. Well, in the afternoon, try one. Just late in the evening before the talk or the question, try another one. As obviously, the more tickets you buy for a lottery, the more likely you see you win. Okay. How do you deal with people close to us who treat their teachers like Korean stars and couldn't stop buying things and indulging their teachers with overpriced meals and trips? Never happens to me. No, do not treat any monks like a royalty. I understand that different streams of Buddhism are a little different in terms of handing money and things, but surely a good teacher shouldn't allow things to go off balance in such a way, I agree. Or perhaps there are sutras on how to or not to show respect to our teachers. The nicest thing to show to a teacher is to come up and just to say, you've been practicing well, and you have some wonderful attainments, that things are changing in your life, you're kinder, you're healthier, your relationships are doing well. That's, to any teacher. Imagine your parents, really good parents. All they really want is for their kids to do well in life, to be happy, successful, healthy. That's what they want more than anything else. They don't want money or gifts. And it's the same with no spiritual teacher. Nothing makes me happier if I'm no teacher that you're more peaceful and happy and healthy. Your meditation is going well. That's what we want. And so, you know, if things go well, how do you show your gratitude? Whatever I give you, this is what Ajahn Chah told me. Whatever I give you, Ajahn Brahm, don't give it back to me. Because if I help you and you help me back, that's finished. We're even. He said, if I help you, you go and help somebody else. And to tell them that the only way of paying off my debt to you, if I've been teaching you good things, you have to go and help somebody else. So whatever I give you, you're in debt to me. And the only way to pay off that debt is to pay somebody else. And they pay somebody else. And they give it to somebody else. And they give it to somebody else. And then the gift of kindness, of generosity, of forgiveness goes on and on and on. So if I forgive you, don't say, well, Ajahn Brahm, I forgive you too. All those bad jokes. No, no, no. If I forgive you and you accept that, then you have to go and forgive somebody else. And tell them you have to go and forgive somebody else. It's a gift which never stops. It goes on and on and on. But buying stuff for teachers, though, honestly, sometimes you go over to, if it's Hong Kong or Indonesia, and people give you gifts. They give you robes. How many robes can you wear? One of these lasts for 2 or 3 years. And it's really hard. You can't carry robes on an aircraft. You know, they're really heavy. So you don't need to offer robes to a monk. You know, and what else are you going to offer to a monk? And people keep giving me chocolate. You know, I don't hardly... Actually, look at me, you know. I don't take that much chocolate. This is chocolate. This is tea. This is cheese or whatever. You don't need much. A real monk doesn't need much. And sometimes you put these things in. You know what I do with them usually? If it's anything which is nice, I go and auction it off. You know, my birthday's coming soon. And then, so all this stuff which you give me and accumulate over the year, we auction it, get rid of it. But it goes to a good cause, and then, you know, we get some money for the monasteries which you're building or this place or whatever. So, but, you know, it's too much stuff. So, please, you don't need to offer stuff. Just offer your kindness, your joy. That's much better. Last question. Can you talk about the stories about a heavenly being? Thanks a lot. I won't talk about the stories of a heavenly being this evening. I'll let you dream about them when you go to sleep in a few minutes or half an hour's time. So there you can dream about heavenly beings. Because it's 9:20 and you've got a bit of translation to do and another busy day tomorrow. So... Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So again, if I rushed through your question, didn't answer it appropriately because there's a lot of questions, so please excuse me. If it's really important for you, write it again, we'll try again. Tomorrow night won't work, will it? On Saturday night. Or sometime.